Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, April the 17th. And I'm looking forward to your participation as we talk this hour with the author of The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. But unlike most of the guests we have heard on this program, American and British scholars and journalists and politicians and policymakers and military experts, our guest today offers an Iraqi perspective. Since the invasion, Ali Alawi has served as Minister of Trade of Iraq, Iraq's first post-war civilian Minister of Defense, and as an elected member of Iraq's Transitional National Assembly. He has also served as the Minister of Finance in the Transitional National Government. He's a graduate of MIT. He has an MBA from Harvard University, and he is in Boston today, where he's going to be talking about the ideas in his book. And you can talk with him right now by calling 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Ali Alawi joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Joy.
Well, I'm going to start with a question that's probably on the minds of maybe everyone listening. When do you think the U.S. should be able to withdraw troops from Iraq?
Well, when it should withdraw or when it could withdraw, two different things, I think. I believe it should withdraw whenever there is a suitable political and diplomatic resolution to the crisis in Iraq, to resolving the consequences of the war. But, of course, it could withdraw at any time. It could withdraw as a result of domestic U.S. pressures, or it could withdraw as a result of the increasing alienation of the Arab population of Iraq from the occupying forces.
Yeah, we know Congress is getting back to work this week in sending the president a bill that would fund the war in Iraq, but also contain some sort of conditions or timetable for withdrawal, which the president says he will veto this particular bill. What would happen if a timetable was set? Would that be bad as far as you're concerned? A timetable for U.S. withdrawal?
Not really. Contrary to what most observers think, I don't think there will be an increase in violence. I think what will happen is that the government, which is dominated by Shia-related parties, will begin to be obliged, as it were, to exercise its authority through the military forces, through the security forces. So the consequences of American withdrawal are not likely to be an increase in violence, but more an increase in the sectarian makeup of the government and a greater sectarianization of the country.
Hmm. So you think a timetable would be a good thing to have in place?
On balance, yes, but I think it has to be linked to a political and diplomatic offensive, as it were, on the part of the United States in order to create a political system, a resolution of the issues arising from the Iraq crisis, which cannot be resolved through continuing military means.
Yeah. What sorts of political and diplomatic offenses are needed?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the underlying premise is that there is a central Iraqi government that is non-sectarian, non-ethnic, and is able to exercise its authority on the entirety of the country. And what is needed is just to defeat a few recalcitrant insurgents. The reality is much different. The reality is that Iraq has been turned upside down because of the war and because of the invasion. There's been a profound shift in the internal political balance of power, which has put the Shia for the first time in a position of power. And this has created ripple effects throughout the area and inside Iraq, of course. And these have not been adequately addressed, in the sense that the fears of the anxieties of the dispossessed Sunni Arab minority is also matched by the fear of neighboring countries as to what kind of state would be installed in Iraq as a result of the Shia domination over a substantial part of the country. At the same time, Kurds have been given a massive fillip, as it were, to their march for a state of their own, or at least a high degree of autonomy. And that, in turn, threatens countries like Turkey no end, because it raises the specter of Kurds inside Turkey demanding similar arrangements.
Yeah.
So the Iraq war has had really very profound effects internally and in the region. And unless these are addressed consciously in a new system that takes that into account, I think we'll continue to have instability.
Yeah, well, we'll talk more about some of that new system you would like to see in place. What could be done, can be done to, allay the fears of the Sunni so some of the sectarian violence ends?
Well, I think it is, to some extent, an existential fear, because for the last 1,000 or 1,400 years, depending how you look at it, the Sunni Arab minority, in one form or another, either through their own control over the Iraqi government, or before that, through Iraq being part of a Sunni-dominated empire, like the Ottoman Empire, there's a certain set of rights and privileges and benefits associated with that supremacy. That has been turned upside down. The Shia are a minority in the Muslim world, in the sense that they don't account for more than 15%. And Iraq has always been viewed as a sort of integral part of the Arab and Sunni Muslim world. So when you have this profound change, profound makeover of the country, or remakeover of the country, the anxiety is that there will be reverse discrimination, as it were, and reverse distortion to the power structures. These, I think, need to be addressed in some form of non-sectarian government that would manage the affairs at least of the Arabs of Iraq. The Kurds, I assume, will not willingly accede to the idea of Iraqi citizenship that submerges their own identity.
Yeah. So is Iraq in a civil war right now?
I think it's it is a civil war by any metric, if you want to use that word. But it's more like a chaotic civil conflict, more like a Hobbesian state, that many groups and subgroups are fighting each other, and each for limited reasons, for geographical reasons, for boundaries, for turf, as well as this sort of overarching crisis between the mainly or exclusively Sunni Arab insurgents and the Shia-dominated central government on the one side. So you have several conflicts going on for different kinds of objectives. You have conflicts within the Shia between various elements of the Sadrist movement and those who would challenge them in the south of the country, like the movement, the party associated with the Hakim family, the so-called Skiri. You have criminality spread throughout large parts of the south. You have insurgents in various guises and forms. You have, of course, the terrorists of Al-Qaeda. And you have conflicts in cities like Kirkuk and, to a lesser extent, Mosul, between Kurds and Arabs and Turkmen and Kurds. So it's a multifaceted breakdown, as it were.
Yeah. I see in the news that this morning that six Iraqi cabinet ministers loyal to the Shiite cleric al-Sadr have resigned. They're protesting the prime minister's refusal to set a timetable for U.S. troops to pull out of Iraq. How significant is this?
This has been going on really for some time. I mean, the possibility of Muqtada al-Sadr pulling out his cabinet ministers has been on the cards for the last maybe two or three months. So it's not really surprising. I think it's they'll go out with a whimper, as it were, not a bang. But it is significant in another way, in the sense that it shows that there has been a rupture between the prime minister, who is backed for that post by the Sadrists, and the Sadrists themselves, who are responding to some extent to popular pressures to set a timetable for withdrawal of U.S. forces. The government, of course, sees it differently, and that may have been a contributing factor. other contributing factors is the crackdown on the Mehdi army may have gone further than what the Sadrs had expected, and has also created tensions between them and the government. But I don't think it will break the government.
We're talking with Ali Alawi. He is the author of The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Ali Alawi is the former Minister of Finance, Trade, and Defense of Iraq. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, 21 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, April the 17th. Well, as you probably know, the tragedy, the shootings at Virginia Tech yesterday have prompted Congress to cancel its hearing with Alberto Gonzalez, the U.S. Attorney General. That hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee has been postponed until Thursday. We will provide coverage of that hearing on Thursday. The coverage we had planned for today obviously postponed. Instead, our regular program schedule, Kathleen Dunn after 9 o'clock, we'll be talking with two guests about more on the aftermath of that shooting at Virginia Tech yesterday. We're talking with the author of The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace, Ali Alawi, the former Minister of Finance, Trade, and Defense of Iraq, giving us a rare opportunity to talk with an Iraqi official, an Iraqi voice on what's going on in Iraq, what went wrong in Iraq, and how it might be turned around. Mr. Alawi, you say we're losing the peace. Tell us, if you can, in less than an hour here, what we need to do to win the peace in Iraq?
Well, I mean, peace, as far as I'm concerned, is to do with a structure that is stable and that is secure, and at the same time is a form of civil peace that would lead to some fair and just society for Iraq's inhabitants. What we don't have is that right now. And I think the mantra that's repeated all the time, that the U.S. wants a government that can defend and sustain itself, really flies against the conflicts that are becoming more and more ruinous to the country. So winning the peace, as far as I'm concerned, is really basically jettisoning the military-based policy that has been pursued over the last 4 years, where everything is reduced to a legitimate, constitutionally elected government versus insurgents. I mean, if you look at it in this kind of bold way, it's not going to lead to the desired end result. So I think what needs to be done now is to basically do a 180-degree U-turn and to strengthen the political and diplomatic side to the conflict, as it were, as you bring down the military dimension, because the military dimension is directly connected. The insecurity is directly connected to the breakdown of the kind of society that Iraq was before and the kind of politics it had before, and a new politics and a new society that is not yet fully born or fully formed. And once you recognize that the United States, unwittingly, I think, sort of broke the crockery in the China shop, you have to really set to the task of putting it together. And this means really, as I said, ratcheting up the political and diplomatic dimension to it, which means that you have to face the consequences of upending Iraq's political and social order, and their effects on the region.
Yeah. What does that mean? The U.S. should talk to, say, Iran and Syria?
Yeah, I mean, it goes beyond talking to them in either directly or indirectly through regional conferences. I think there should be some kind of international congress that would lead the end result of which would be a kind of treaty that would define the boundaries of Iraq and guarantee the internal political settlement in ways to limit the gains of the gainers, limit the loss of the losers, without necessarily changing or reversing the changes that have taken place, but in ways that would calm the anxieties also of nearby countries. For example, the fact that the Shia are now a dominant group in Iraq should not translate into a Shia-dominated government as such. That would be sectarian. The fact that Iran has been, his power has been increased, should not lead to Iranian interference in Iraqi affairs. The fact that the Kurds are now in a more advantageous position for claiming their own regional autonomy or even marching towards some kind of state of their own should not be at a speed or rate that would threaten the national security of Turkey. The dominance of the Shia in Iraq should not lead to Iraq espousing, as it were, the cause of the minority Shias in other Arab countries. This can only be done through a kind of international congress that whose end result is a binding agreement that would basically have the international community, led hopefully by the United States in this case, coming up with a resolution to the crisis in a diplomatic and legal form.
Yeah. I'm wondering if this resolution, do you picture this as a three-state solution?
No, the three-state solution will not work. I mean, dividing Iraq into three states, for the simple reason that it will not be accepted by the countries of the area and also internationally. I mean, I doubt very much if three states emerging out of the fabric of Iraq would be recognized. So there will be pariah states with no recognition, even if the people may demand it. But it may very well lead to a high degree of regional autonomy in the country as part of the process of making the central Iraqi government less threatening, both to its citizens as well as to the neighbors. So a regional solution is plausible as part of the outcome.
We're talking with Ali Alawi. He is the former Minister of Finance, Trade, and Defense of Iraq. He has written a book, The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. We're talking with him about what went wrong in Iraq and what must be done to win that peace. And we welcome your questions for him. Our lines are open, which surprises me. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. You mentioned in your last answer, Mr. Alawi, that something along the lines of what that the U.S. unwittingly really screwed up Iraq. Was it really unwittingly? Tell me more about your thoughts on whether this was unwittingly or not.
Well, I have to say unwittingly, because if it's wittingly, then it means that the United States deliberately destroyed Iraq, which is something that I'm not prepared to contemplate, but some people are, I might add. They think the whole thing is a conspiracy to destroy the country.
A lot of people think that the U.S. invaded Iraq because the U.S. wanted the oil. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think really, that's not, I don't think it's plausible, simply because by the time this is over, I think the U.S. would probably have spent nearly $1 trillion trying to secure the country, invade and secure the country. And you have to really take our oil for free for the next 50 years to pay for that, which is really not on the cards. At the same time, anybody who knows anything about how the oil markets work would tell you that you can, a power the size of the United States can influence the oil market in terms of prices, supplies, and regularity and continuity, without necessarily occupying oil fields. I mean, they do that quite easily with the other Gulf countries by pressuring their governments when it suits them. So I think it's a bit far-fetched. But there is, of course, an element of oil to the you know, to the overall policy, in the sense that the U.S. probably wants to see its main oil companies involved in the extraction of oil from Iraq's very large oil fields. Yeah. That's plausible. But I don't think it's in and of itself enough to justify the invasion of the country.
Yeah. Should it have been foreseen that this sectarian violence that we are seeing now, that should the U.S. have foreseen that?
In retrospect, yes, we can make the same case for the Iraqi opposition. I mean, nobody foresaw the extent of resistance and the extent of violence. And people, for example, in my case, I'll tell you frankly, I mean, I was expecting a kind of sullen reluctance on the part of the losers, both Ba'athists and mainly the Sunni Arab community, to the new order. But over a period of time, maybe a few months, they would sort of reconcile themselves to the inevitable that a demographic majority will rule the country, and then try to find a place in the new order. But what we found out, that this really went to the core. It went to people's sense of identity, their sense of what's right or wrong, their sense of their fears. And the response has been far, far more widespread, deep, and the violence much more vicious than we thought. So I don't blame the United States for not knowing that there's going to be huge violence. I do blame them for not knowing any much about Iraq. That's mm-hmm. another issue.
George in La Crosse is with us now. Hi, George, you're on the air.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Alawi. Thank you very much for being on this radio show, because you're giving us the kind of information that we really need.
And
you mentioned that the three-state solution wouldn't work, and I was wondering if you could develop that a little bit more, because, you know, a lot of people are saying that, you know, that's what we should do, and thank you for making the point that now we're at the place where it's a political solution, and the military is, you know, we can't fix this with a hammer. And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you. But thank you very much, man.
Thank you. Should I answer that?
Yes, please.
Well, the three-state solution, I mean, what it really means is that you'll have a Kurdish state, a Sunni Arab state, and a Shia Arab state. A Kurdish state with its own army and flag and territory and so on will not be accepted by Turkey. It's as simple as that. And at the present moment, if such a state is declared, I think Turkey will invade it. A Shia Arab state creates its own problems, because it makes the Shia Arab into a nation. And this is something that they're not yet prepared to accept. I mean, Shias are Arabs also. And they are not only, you know, Arabized people, they're actually tribal Arabs. So it's something that goes against their identity. And unless the Shias decide that they are a nation, then they would not be very happy in a state of their own. The Sunni Arab state also cannot sustain itself, because it would not have the resources, and would probably be absorbed ultimately to Jordan or Saudi Arabia or something like that. So it's not a stable end outcome, in the sense that one of the units will be invaded, another one will probably be absorbed by a third country or divided up, and the third unit will be a pariah state. So, but that doesn't mean that they would not be a kind of three-way confederation, where the sort of structure of Iraq as a state will continue. That is more plausible and may very well happen.
Thank you very much, George, for the call. You say there's a political and diplomatic solution, not a military solution, but do you, Mr. Alawi, have any thoughts on how long U.S. troops likely will stay in Iraq?
I mean, obviously, if they don't follow these prescriptions, then I think My travels in America and my discussion with my American friends and so on makes it clear to me that you sort of reached a tipping point here. And unless there's a dramatic improvement in the security situation in Baghdad in the next, say, 2 or 3 months, I think it will spill over onto the other side. So there's no political will anymore to keep the U.S. Forces there, except by the current administration, which is unlikely to change its policy. So I think that the U.S. forces will probably start pulling out in next year sometime. Now, whether they pull out completely or not is another issue, but they will no longer be in the size and number that we have now by, let's say, the summer of next year.
And you don't think that will be disastrous if that happens?
No, I don't think it will be disastrous in the sense that we'll have a worse war. But it is wrong for Iraqis to be saddled with an end state that is unstable, that is insecure, and that is violent. I'm looking at it from an Iraqi point of view, which is my point of view. So from an Iraqi point of view, I think we now have something called the U.S. military, which is an important chip, as it were. Sorry to use that expression. But if you look at it politically, that presence can be used effectively to push towards a political and diplomatic end state that would be better for Iraqis than without that chip or being on the block.
Do you have any sense if the surge, the increase in troops, is working in stabilizing the country, making it more secure?
I think the surge is working to some extent in Baghdad, in the sense that Baghdad, large number of neighborhoods are more safe than they were before. Maybe that could be due to the surge. It could also be due to the fact that a lot of ethnic and sectarian cleansing has already taken place in Baghdad. We have a very large internal refugee problem and external refugee problem. Something like 1.5 million people have been displaced internally because of sectarian and ethnic cleansing, and another 1.5 to 2 million people have been driven abroad, mainly to Jordan and Syria. So you could say that the surge succeeded, or that it would have succeeded anyway because of the changing demographies. But I don't think it can become an important element in stabilizing the country outside of Baghdad. It's a necessary move, I think, but I wouldn't bank too much on it.
Two more callers. Linda in Pewaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have three brief questions, the first of which might have been answered while my call is being taken, so you can disregard it if it was. Why do you think the U.S. did invade Iraq? Should the Iraqi people vote on when and whether the U.S. should leave? And is it true that there is a huge permanent U.S. base being built in Iraq?
Well, why the U.S. invaded is something I try to come to terms with in my book. There isn't really a single answer. I think it would not have invaded were it not for the peculiar composition of the Bush administration and 9/11, frankly. These made the decision to invade possible. There were a number of reasons. One is to make over Iraq as a society and country. Another one was to turn Iraq into a kind of platform for liberal democracy in the area and as a goad to the Arab authoritarian governments. Another one, which we discussed, was oil, partly. Of course, the ostensible reason was weapons of mass destruction and the war on terror. The weapons of mass destruction were not found. And the war on terror, you can say many things about the former Saddam regime. It was extremely brutal and vicious and in many cases genocidal or near genocidal. But it steered well clear from the United States and was not really involved in terrorism against the U.S. In the end, I think the policies that drove America to invade and occupy became incoherent as a result of the post-war confusion as to what to do with this country. So I can't really point to one reason, except to say that there was a drive towards war because of 9/11, and it would not have happened were it not for the Bush administration, because it's a very, very unusual, in many cases, outlandish act to invade a country. It's one of the first times since World War II that something like this has happened on this scale.
Should the Iraqi people vote on whether the U.S. troops stay or go?
I think if they do, there'll be two communities. The Kurds want them to stay as long as possible. The Arabs probably now, in their overwhelming majority, want them to leave. But if they vote on whether they want to go, the question is whether the government, which is using the American military as part of its internal power struggles, would accept that decision or not.
Yeah. And is the U.S. building permanent bases in Iraq?
They are. They're building a very large world-class base north of Baghdad in a place called Balad. but so-called Anaconda project. But the U.S. builds these bases and frequently abandons them. So it's, the U.S. maintains something like 750 bases around the world. And this may very well be one of them, one more.
We are talking with Ali Alawi. He is the author of The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. He is the former Minister of Finance, Trade, and Defense of Iraq. 1-800-642-1234 is our toll-free number if you would like to talk with him, have a question for him, in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen and her guests will talk about the shootings yesterday at Virginia Tech. That's coming up. We're talking with Ali Alawi, who is the former Minister of Finance, Trade, and Defense of Iraq. He's the author of The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. Laura in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have an observation, and then I have a question that builds off of that. I see the sectarian violence in Iraq very similar to gang violence in the United States. So I'm wondering if any strategies have been in place to get rid of the sectarian violence that are similar to what the U.S. uses to get rid of gang violence. And if not, do you think these strategies would be successful?
Now, what kind of strategies do you think police are using to get rid of gang violence, Laura?
Well, in the United States, it's more of like undercover, you know, undercover strategies where people are, or police officers are getting involved in the gang activity. So I'm wondering if something like that would actually work, you know, in with sectarian violence in the in Iraq.
Mr. Alawi?
Well, I mean, parts of the violence are, in fact, gang-related and turf wars and criminality and so on. But this is sort of at the base of the violence. As you go up the chain, the perpetrators become more and more organized and they become larger and larger. I mean, you can't call the Mehdi Army, for example, a gang. I mean, it has nearly 40,000 members and it has shoulder-fired missiles. So as you move up the feeding chain, as it were, the nature of the violence changes. In some parts of the country, I mean, your caller is right. In some parts of the country, it is gang violence, but much more organized and much more controlling. Gangs here, for example, city gangs in a major American city don't control city hall. Neither do they control the police. Neither do they control elements outside of their own neighborhood. In the case of Iraq, these gangs blend into large smuggling rackets, and they have infiltrated town halls and provincial governments and police forces and so on. So it's more. Not only is it more complicated, but it's much harder to root out through just police action.
Thank you, Laura. Valerie in Madison is with us now. Hi, Valerie.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. My question is what Mr. Alawi is saying about what his vision is for how to resolve the situation in Iraq sounds so reasonable and sane, and it's not the kind of thing we hear from the Bush administration. And what I'm wondering is, does Mr. Alawi think that the Bush administration is thinking it all along the lines of what he's talking about, Mr. Alawi, and planning anything along the lines of his strategy? But not talking about it to the public.
I have to say that I've been out of the government now for a few months, so I don't know what's the details of these negotiations. But what I have seen, I was in Washington a few days ago, and frankly, I don't think the Bush administration is willing or able to change course for a number of reasons. One, politically, to them, probably doesn't make sense to admit that their previous defeat, their previous policy has been ended in failure. Mm-hmm. The second reason is that I don't think they are ideologically prepared, as it were, to fully abandon the drives that they had that drove them into Iraq. So that makes it also difficult. I mean, some personalities have changed. the more radical or extreme people have left. But still, there is a residual feeling that something could be rescued out of this. It's like a, you know, this sunk cost argument. So I do not think that they are able to do a U-turn on their own. They may just, I mean, it has happened in the past where a party who has espoused a policy very, very strongly all of a sudden changes. It's possible. I'm not sure whether it is probable in this case, but it's possible it could happen.
Thank you, Valerie, for the call. Jeff in Price County, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for all the excellent shows. I got a bunch of items here. They're all related to the same thing, and it's about the defense contractors. Back in 2003 in the Milwaukee Journal, there was an article, One Soldier's Story. It talked about all the money that has been reaped in by Halliburton and the defense contractors, the soldier that came back from Iraq. If this war was losing money on Wall Street, we wouldn't be in this war. Dennis Kucinich stated that on CNN over the weekend. And is it true that Dick Cheney has 400 million shares in Halliburton?
Yeah, and, I don't know if our guest can answer that.
I heard there's just as many private people working the military as there are soldiers in Iraq. So it sounds to me like it's all about money. What have you got to say about that?
Well, I think, I mean, there's an element of truth in the observation that was just made. Well, a large element of truth. Mm-hmm. The war is being more and more privatized, and all kinds of companies and oddball groups are now taking the role of the military. And Iraq was probably the first war of that kind, where I was Minister of Defense, and I could see the privatization or the commercialization of war. A lot of private contractors doing things that the military used to do. And in the process, I think, because there was very poor oversight and poor controls, some of them really abused their power and their privileges and took money, skimmed money, huge amounts of money, from the American taxpayer as well as from the Iraqi government. In some cases, these contractors had extra-territorial or extra-legal rights, which are not frequently given. For example, Bremer, when he was head of the occupation authority, issued an order that basically absolved all private military contractors from any blame or culpability for anything that they do. So a private security contractor can walk up to an Iraqi, shoot him in the face, and not be prosecuted. The privatization of war was also moved on to nearly everything. I mean, logistics, supplies, and it is really quite a strange sight to see the U.S. military, which is doing the fighting and the killing, and is being killed, carries behind it this chain of camp followers that stretch all the way across the world, and it's a world that we, you know, that people don't frequently see, but we saw it in reality in Iraq. And it's not something that is, I think, good, this privatization of war, because it leads to huge abuse.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff. Drew in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Alawi. I'm curious whether or not the people in Iraq generally consider the private security forces as part of the U.S. Army. And the reason I'm interested is because I want to know whether or not that then is included in the polling questions when they're asked whether or not they want the U.S. Army to stay or leave.
I mean, the private security forces are really very, very unpopular. They come from various, they're contracted from various countries. In the beginning, they were mainly Americans and Brits, but then over time they became from other countries like Eastern Europe and Romania, and now countries from Central Asia and Africa. But they are extremely unpopular because they really do not in any shape or form try to engage with the public, and they have these extraterritorial rights. They barge around, they charge around in their SUVs and so on. So part of the dislike, the intense dislike for the foreign presence in Iraq is to some extent caused by the behavior of these people and their arrogance and their swagger and so on. The American military, by and large, is advised to stay out of people's way. But these people, you see them daily because they do all the checking, they do the body searches, they have their dogs that go around sniffing. Iraqis generally are not very keen on animals. So it creates a very unpleasant environment.
Our guest, Ali Alawi, he is the author of The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. Mr. Alawi, the former Minister of Finance, Trade, and Defense of Iraq. Michael in Appleton joins us next. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my question. I'd like to ask two quick questions. The first is the title of the book, Winning the War. Did we ever win the war yet? And number two, the guest still continues to proscribe the freedom of people like was done after the First World War, the Second World War. Why don't we continue to think that the Kurds or the Shiites could be, or the Sunnis could be on their own rather than killing one another? Thank you very much for taking my question.
On the first part, I think when I said winning the war, I meant the military battle between the United States and the Iraqi army of the Ba'ath regime of Saddam. And this was really not more than a three-week affair. And there was no doubt who was going to win this military confrontation. So that was that. But it's the post-war war that is the subtext, as it were, of losing the peace. The peace that was supposed to follow quickly thereafter soon degenerated. So winning the war side, I think, referred specifically to the military confrontation between two organized armies. The second part of the question, I think, is to do with national rights of people. National rights, you see, apart from the Kurds, the others don't see themselves, at least not yet, in terms of nations. They are part of larger entities. And there is also a sense of, still a strong sense of Iraqiness about the Arab population of Iraq, both Sunni and Shia. And that hasn't gone away in spite of the fighting, in spite of the killings. But the Kurds were sort of promised a state after World War I, but it was then reneged on. And they were... The Kurdish population of the Middle East was carved up into Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Syria, and so on. So they didn't get their state. Now we are facing the consequence of that.
Let's go next to Mary Jo in DeForest. Hi, Mary Jo. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I would like to hear the guests' views on Saudi Arabia's part or role in all of this, and I can just hang up and listen.
That's a very good question. I mean, Saudi Arabia is I think, instrumental in isolating the Shia-dominated Iraqi government, and they're also indirectly responsible for the insurgency, including the more extreme versions of it. Saudi Arabia, in the last 30 years since the beginning of the oil boom, has been spreading its Wahhabi version of Islam throughout the world and has backed it with huge amounts of money. In Iraq itself, there was very little leeway because the country was ruled by a secular Ba'athist dictatorship. But in the 1990s, the Ba'athist government of Saddam decided to increase, as it were, the religious component of its identity and strengthened Sunni ideology and religious prescriptions. It's at that point that the Sunnis of Iraq became more and more radicalized by preachers who were trained in these Wahhabi way of thinking. So the Saudis, by supporting this extreme form of Islam, or their version of it, have helped to radicalize the thinking of and the behavior of Sunnis and Sunni Arabs in Iraq and elsewhere. So I think they are responsible for this, because before that we had 1,000 years of quite extensive coexistence between the two communities that didn't spill over into killings. But introducing this intolerance that comes from Wahhabism was part of Saudi Arabia's pact with its own Wahhabi clerical classes. At the same time, the Saudi government has sort of quarantined the Iraqi government in at least in Arab organizations and Islamic organizations in ways by cold shouldering it, and also in another way they allow for quite unfettered flow of money from private Saudi sources to finance the insurgency. So I think their role is really quite seriously disruptive at all levels.
Yeah, let me bring us back full circle here with our last email from Dave in Menominee. He says, I have become convinced that the presence of the U.S. military in Iraq is prolonging the sectarian and terrorist violence and instability in the country, and only a complete withdrawal of our forces will begin to change that situation. Despite the dire predictions from our administration that leaving before we secure the country will lead to some sort of regional catastrophe, I think it's the best chance for Iraq to work out its own fate. What's your view, Mr. Alawi?
I think it is true that the U.S. that if the U.S. pulls out, as I said, we're not likely to get a collapse. But what we're likely to get an outcome that is not necessarily the most suitable, or even partly suitable for Iraq's own population. I don't think, as I said, that the U.S. should stay there for military reasons, for trying to secure the country militarily. If that's the case, then they should leave now. But if the U.S. military presence is drawn down, but replaced by a much greater political and diplomatic presence of the United States, then I think the end result might be quite good. If we end up, it would not compensate for all the damage and loss and killings that have happened, but it will be a better outcome for the Iraqi people. The presence of U.S. forces in and of itself, I don't think would solve anything, and for internal reasons, I think they might as well leave. But if it is to do with maintaining or replacing that with a much more intensive engagement, political and diplomatic, then I would be in favor of that. But in neither case, I think there should be a drawdown.
We are out of time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Ali Alawi is the former Minister of Finance, Trade, and Defense of Iraq. He is the author of The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and to Leo Duran for on-air production. As always, thank you for listening and calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.